Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi. Before the show starts, I'll tell you about a super exclusive deal to you from our new sponsor, Uber. Uber is an app-based ride-sharing service that, at the tap of a button, connects you with a driver in Stockholm, Gothenburg, and over 250 other cities around the globe. I just came home from Los Angeles, and it works like a charm both here and there. It's stylish, safe, and cheaper than regular taxi. With the promo code VARVET, you will get your first trip free up to 150 Swedish kronor. If you want to support VARVET International, take a trip with Uber and download the Uber app now. It's available in any app store and enter the code VARVET. The code is VARVET and the app is called Uber. Okay, thanks in advance and thank you, Uber.
I didn't come with a lot of money. I came with $300 to this country and a vision.
Varvet. 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 Varvet.
International.
Varvet.
International.
Varvet.
International.
Varvet.
International.
Welcome to the 18th episode of Varvet International. With me, Christopher Triumph. I woke up this morning here in West Hollywood. The sun shines. It's a beautiful day, and I'm so happy that you're listening to this podcast. Yeah, I love you for that. Thank you. Now, this week's guest is Marcus Samuelsson. He has cooked for President Obama at the White House. He was the youngest chef ever to get a 3-star review in the New York Times. And he serves dignitaries, celebrities such as Bill Clinton and said president and other fine diners every night at his successful Harlem restaurant Red Rooster. Top Chef Marcus Samuelsson may be exactly what you call the American dream, but this by the way of Ethiopia and Sweden. Samuelsson was born in Ethiopia and adopted to a family in Sweden at the age of 3, and he grew up in the west coast of Sweden, enchanted by his grandmother's Swedish cooking. In his adolescence, he was being taught to master the art of food making at some of the most prestigious restaurants and hotels in Europe, and he ended up at Akvavit, a Swedish restaurant in the middle of Manhattan. Since then, he's won the US TV program Top Chef Masters, and his stardom has just exploded. He's a superstar here. And his road to celebrity hasn't been easy, but he has been ambitious, honest, and he has been able to cook really good food. Now, Marcus is a really, really busy guy, but we managed to get one of his hours, and we sat down in Harlem at his restaurant, Red Rooster, a few months back, and I really enjoyed this talk, so let's just roll the tape, shall we? Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Right now in the basement, the downstairs, the Ginny Supper Club.
Yeah, I was thinking, because I would like to make a sound check, and I would like you to, while we do that, just, if you could describe the setting for us.
Well, right now you're in New York, you're in northern Manhattan, you're in Harlem, where I live, and where we have Red Rooster. And in Red Rooster is really divided into, it's one home, right north of 125th Street, but it's really two special places in one. It's Ginny's Supper Club, where we pay homage to the great jazz and musicians and storytellers and actors and writers that is of Harlem and been inspired by Harlem. And upstairs is a restaurant, Red Rooster. So
it's a fantastic place.
Well, we've been blessed with, first of all, where we are, the place, Harlem itself. It's pretty magical in terms of its sense of history and culture, but also we're discovering, in this journey that people have a thirst for Harlem, where it came from, where it is today, and where it's going. So in a world where we're constantly overexposed with stuff, a place like, it's pretty fascinating to think about a place like in New York can be still underexposed.
But it's slowly getting more and more attention, or?
Well, I mean, you know, creativity is the core of that, right? Like creativity is one of these things that, you know, it was all over Manhattan, Soho, Tribeca, but then when things get too expensive, a lot of creative kids move to Brooklyn, and then other people start to say, well, what else is there? There's places like Harlem, and out of that, when you start undiscovering, unpeeling that, you realize like Harlem has incredible bones and frames, you know, from we stand on the shoulder of people from the Great Migration coming from the South, coming north, but then also what did they bring with them? Culture, and food, history, and music, art. And that's, you know, out of that comes Apollo, out of that comes the supper clubs, the museums, the artists, the writers. So I think creativity will always evolve, and places where creativity comes from will never really be new places, because that would be saying, like, for the creative people that are there before, it's like if we would have the same boom in the Bronx, people say, oh, something is happening, you know, Bronx is really happening. Well, out of the Bronx came hip-hop and graffiti, so Bronx been happening for a very, very long time, you know?
How long have you been living in Harlem?
I lived for about 10 years in Harlem, and I lived in the States for 15 years. So, you know, Harlem has always been on my mind and always been in a very special place to me. Even when I lived on the West Side, or I lived, you know, like everyone in New York, has done the traditional five roommates, got kicked out. But I enjoyed that time too, you know what I mean? Like that's part of coming to New York, right? Or any urban major city, and you create great bonds and friends from that time. And then eventually you start, maybe you go through three to four different places before you find the place, right? In a city like New York or London or Stockholm or something like that. And, you know, I started on the Lower East Side, which I think is magical too. And then I lived in Hell's Kitchen, which has its beauty. It's a fantastic place as well. And then eventually I find myself here in Harlem. But it takes a while, and, you know, it's like what speaks to you, and this, you know, the mix between the low buildings and the parks and the people and the brownstones, it speaks to me.
Of course, this is your home, but would you say that this place defines you the most?
For now, for my, you know, as an adult, yes.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I've been blessed with, but I actually think most people are blessed with, they come from a place, right, which is very important to them, but then they very often move to another place, or maybe go to school in another place, and then they are adult maybe in a third place. And those three things can actually be in the same city sometimes, but they're very different tones and nuances in that city, or in the same country, or in the same continent, you know what I mean? So it doesn't have to be as, for me, where you have sort of these defined by Africa, Sweden, and New York and Harlem. I have these three sort of boxes that are very clear to me, windows in. So for other people, that might not be that clear. But, you know, I remember my parents, you know, both come from the west coast of Sweden, one from Helsingborg and one from Smögen. And they're both essentially cities surrounded by water. But my mom comes 20 minutes from the inland, so she doesn't relate to fishing culture. 20 minutes away from the water. So she's a meat eater. And my father was raised on the water. And these tiny little things clearly define how we ate.
It's funny that you're very kind to Smögen when you call it a city.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, it's a magical place by itself. I mean, especially where we're from, a tiny little place. But
Smögen is fantastic.
Yeah. When it finds its core, when it doesn't... When the fishing culture is in the center, in the heart of it, yes.
Because it's overflocked with tourists in the summer.
Yeah.
Can you even stand it?
Well, I mean, it has its place, right? Because as an adult, it's also where I spent all my summers as a kid. So that's how we got summer jobs. So you know the necessity of it, but it's very short. And, you know, I'm a huge soccer fan, but, you know, when the ratio of Zlatan t-shirts are more than selling fish, then there's something have happened in the culture. And I'm a huge Zlatan fan, but you know, when you walk, when you go down to the village, and I still want to, I love just watching when the fisherman comes in with the shellfish and the seafood, because that's essentially the core. You know, smelling for me has a smell.
Yeah, it has.
And it has salt in the air and it has sounds, you know. And if you're there in mid-July, you might think that that smell is beer, which is a good smell too. But it's really the smell of salt.
It's super special to be there in the summer because, like, the boats, they lay along the quay. And then there's like 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 boats outside of that one. So it's jam-packed.
Yeah, it is.
Really.
Yeah.
What's your first memory of food?
Well, I would say, I mean, the relationship to nature is something that was really defined by my grandparents, both on my mom's and my dad's side in Sweden. And my mom's side, it was, we went berry picking. So eating sour lingon tart lingonberries, eating blueberries, unripe blueberries, because as a kid, you don't really know when it's the season to eat them. So I remember that and remember the mess. But then,
if they're green,
yeah,
don't eat them.
Yeah, but I we knew that much, but because my sisters are older than me, were always with us. But then also, I think, like, fish, mackerel, because that was summertime for us, mackerel. And the question wasn't really, are we eating mackerel today? It was like, what time? Is it, what type? Are we going to smoke it? Is it going to be? It was really, are we going to have herring or are we going to have a mackerel? And then maybe one day we had meatball summertime. But it was a fish-based diet, and I loved that.
So that's your first memory?
Yeah, I would say so.
I would just like to address the fact, could you tell us what's happening on the other side of the wall
here?
This is
a very important part of the, you know, the restaurant is, this restaurant is a 24-hour operation. It doesn't mean we're open 24-hour, but there's something happening 24 hours. So at night, the cleaning crew comes in. And we're shifting now. So the cleaning crew is leaving, but they're eating breakfast, which is essentially their dinner almost, right? So, and this is also when the staff meetings are starting. We're starting the day. You know, a restaurant has, I don't know any other workplace that has clear about two different, where the blue collar, where the trade, where the craftsmen, and then it switch over to action and lights, and the show is happening, right? But both sides are equally important. You, as a guest, might only relate to it from one side, but this part of the day is crucial for a functioning restaurant, crucial part. People are talking, we're fixing the restaurant, we're cleaning it up, we're draining the restaurant from a lot of different things and just getting ready for lunch, and then in the afternoon, almost the same thing's happening, new crew comes in, and then dinner, and then it's really action and live.
But the staff here, they love your restaurant, or?
Well, I mean, it's a labor, it's a place of labor, and it's a workplace, but if you just come here for a paycheck, you can't work here. You have to be committed to the larger vision, which is we're working in a place and of a place here in Harlem. Man, and it's hard when you have 150 staff just here to have everybody on the same page. So I would be the first one to say, it's hard to have 150 people on the same page. So I would say we probably have 80% of the staff that understand the mission. But we work every day to have everybody on the same page because it's a choice. And it's not like we have a choice and they have a choice. They're highly educated, highly smart, intelligent people that choose to spend this time, the 10 hours of their work, of their day, or whatever it is, or the 8 hour, the 4 hour, depending on how you work, with each other. It's a choice.
How are you with what we in Sweden call personalvård? I'm not sure about the term in English.
Well, I mean, how we relate to staff. I mean, I think it's very hard to compare staffing in Sweden and America. I think it's just two different. I mean, Sweden would be like a state in America, right? So you have different starting points, you know. Diversity here, it's not a poster in the back office next to the bathroom, you know. It's reality from staff, from your customer, from everything. That means also diversity of spirituality and diversity of languages and diversity of how one is working and education level. You know, in Sweden, we have diversity too, but the percentage-wise is probably different from both from customer point of view and staff and management point of view. And I say that because not one is better than the other, but I'm just saying it's so hard to compare the two because these that sort of sets the framework. We want the same, the core end, we want the same. We want to give our guest an incredible memory in terms of hospitality. So the end mission and the statement how to is the same, but how to get there, how the song and dance, how to get there, are very, very different.
You do have operations on both mm-hmm. continents. In what way would you say that you are a different kind of boss in the different places?
Very, 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 very. I mean, I would say one of the advantages in Scandinavia and Sweden is that people are very highly, very well educated. There's a base education level that's very high. Most of our staff in Sweden has been on both sides. They've both been, they've been guests a lot. They've traveled a lot. They speak great English so they, or other languages, so they can really understand the guest situation well. And it's, I would say the foundation of that is really a middle class that has been exposed, not only to America, but to other places. That's a huge advantage that I think is an advantage that Scandinavia and Sweden especially is ahead on. Then you can also say that it's hard. It can be harder sometimes to motivate Swedish staff because they like American staff come from different backgrounds. So a lot of my staff's goal is to become middle class. So this is a different starting point. And that changes everything when you say your choices of, hey, someone is sick, can you come in? Sure, I'll be there in 5 minutes. Actually, I live around the corner because I want to pick up that shift. So it's not that one is better than the other, it's just two different realities.
You were born in Ethiopia, 1970. Mm-hmm. What do you remember from Ethiopia?
Well, what I remember from Ethiopia today is mostly the memories. It's a mix between sort of this dreamish thing about what the country was, but also the memories that my sister told me, or I've been told by my other sisters and brothers, or my father that I met as an adult. So it's a really a mosaic memory vision that it's not always based in how it was. It's more based in this collage of memories that's been given to me and passed down to me from others. And, you know, I've been back to Ethiopia so many times, so I know the village, I know the hut where we're from, and I know how far it is from the capital, and I know how, you know, also because I've been exposed to a lot of Ethiopians, both in Ethiopia but also here in New York and in Washington, D.C. So it is a mosaic. And I learned a lot from my wife, you know, that was raised there. So it's not a childhood that maybe that most people's childhood, but everyone, every single person that you meet has a story that is a little bit different than the other person. So, and I learned that. And I learned not to see somebody and guess who and what they are, what's the core. Because it's you're always wrong when you do that.
Yeah. I was curious about, because you are a celebrity. So you must have done like thousands of interviews by this time. I mean, at least from Sweden, we are curious about your background. Has that in any way like affected your memories that you sort of have to tell the stories over and over?
Not really. I mean, I think by writing Yes Chef or We Chef, that is called in Sweden, by writing Yes Chef and the process of writing Yes Chef was really a 10-year process that I was like, so many people approached me was like, oh, you were adopted through a Swedish family, and how was that growing up in Sweden as a black kid and all stuff. I was like, you know what, I'm just going to put it down, paper. Not out of frustration, because you realize that you have something to share. That was normal to me, that my parents were white and my sisters and I, we were black or mixed, and my cousins were Koreans and my other cousins were Canadians. You realize later on that it might not be normal, but whatever is normal, what I mean, that's just never been, I've never really been inspired by that. You know, I've been inspired by other things, abnormal, by Prince and by Miles Davis and by things that are what I consider very clearly abnormal, and those are things that inspires me. So, but I do realize that is something to share, and I understand that, and come to understand that. And so I think that by writing the book and the journey of the book, you know, it was the best way for me to put down this experience. And if that can inspire other people, if that can be a starting point of a conversation in the dialogue of race or in the dialogue of adoption or in the dialogue of identity or a dialogue of family, of new family, great. That's it. I mean, that's what I provide content, right? Whether it's cooking, whether it's restaurants, whether it's books, I provide content. That's why I'm the world in the world of content. I provide it in a very small, local way, and then it can be projected to globally, if that's the appreciation or that's the need or want.
You've talked about the time that your parents picked you up at the airport.
Yeah.
What do you remember from this?
Well, I mean, it's again, it's a mix of my older sister, Anna, is really the one that she explained for me specifically, my mom specifically talked about that moment, because I slept. I was just like, you know, a little child, but...
You were six.
Well, no, I was actually three.
Oh, sorry.
Two and a half, three. So it was more the fact that the mood that my parents were in, nervous, energy, let's go home right away. So this is something that we talked about a lot, and I get it. It's a big happening that went from... Actually, that went from, in a week, from being on a funeral for my father's mother to getting to Stockholm and adding to their family two more kids, you know. So that was, I can understand the emotions that were happening in my family at the time. I get it. Like, I get my mom's anxiety and nervousness, and my father's being a little bit more pragmatic and, okay, we have to decide on birth dates, we have to decide on names, we have to take the kids home, we got to go back, you know, like very, like, you know, structured.
Did they get to decide your birthdays?
Yeah, I mean, they, you know, we went through a lot of different things, but part of, for us, was also, I mean, this is a long time ago, one of the challenges for us was also that we were so malnourished, so we didn't have, you know, the proper weight. You know, one way to tell someone's age is obviously weight and height, and we didn't have the same as an average 2.5-3-year-old. So it was very hard to tell because we didn't really have our birth certificates properly done. So it was just it's just a different way of doing it. So my father picked, actually, May 6th. Today is your sister's birthday. And then November 6th is your birthday. Check. Next. You know, my sister got May 6th.
Oh, okay.
I got November 6th. So I, you know, birthday has always been a funny thing and an interesting thing, so.
I would say that he was nicer to your sister, because in Sweden, well, globally, I guess, it's sort of a good thing to be born early in the year. We competed in school anyway.
Yeah.
I was like, sure, in the middle.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think, look at it more like you're going to be handed cards in life, right? You're going to be handed some good and some bad, and you just like, what do you do with them, you know? I've learned that is something that comes back and again and again and again, and even if you get a handle or good cards, it doesn't mean that you win the poker game. Do you know what I mean?
Mm. And in a way, it's a good thing to have one's birthday in. I mean, it's the most boring time in Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
I would say November.
It's a rough month, but you know, the weather is a little. You know, winter hasn't really begun, and it's raining, but it's cold, and it's dark, but. You know, I loved growing up in Sweden. I loved it. And I think I was a pretty happy child. You know, a lot of stuff happened, but I think overall, when I look at it, it was a great experience, and I wouldn't want to change it for the world. I feel very blessed in terms of education level and what my family provided, you know, in terms of being there for us and guiding us through all the difficult challenges that any child has, you know. My parents, both my mom and my dad and my sisters were there for that. Through tough times and great times.
Did you experience racism?
Sure, but that's not unique to Sweden. That's, you know, that's one of the core things that we're dealing with globally all over the world from many levels. Absolutely not just, I think racism have evolved and it's just part of the fabric of our lives today. You know, it's the conversation has definitely evolved and moved on, but it's in the core of so much, and I couldn't say that racism is unique in America, or it's unique, it doesn't exist in Africa, or it does exist only in Sweden. Absolutely not. It's all over the world, and it's pretty ugly when you go to the core of it. It's pretty ugly.
How did you experience it?
Well, I mean, it's through a lot of different things, through obviously skin color and but they happen mostly, you know. I don't believe that kids are racist, you know. I just don't believe, like, I don't believe an 8-year-old in the world is racist, you know. The parents might be, or their 19-year-old brother might be, but, you know, I just don't believe that an 8-year-old kid is racist. I just don't, because it's too early, too young, too little information, you know. But we were taught, I mean, I think my mom and dad had almost two different approaches on it, where my father was much more, I always felt that race, I was always in race training camp, boot camp with my dad, you know, he knew and saw that this would happen, that this would be, a race would be a major part of our lives. And he taught me just about it constantly, talked to me about it when we drove to soccer practice or when we went rowing and fishing or something like that. This is what we talked about and how to deal with it. And how to deal with it as a young boy, but also as a man. Where my mom was more like, don't take shit from anyone. Yeah, this is, you know, she was more like, you know, you have to look in a certain way. You have to always be very prideful. You have to be. She was more like loving, hugging. You know, if somebody says anything, I'll go to school with you. And all you wanted was not to have your mom to go to school with you. That's like the last thing you wanted. So you knew you had to deal with it in the house. If you're going to bring it home, there was almost two different buckets to deal with it. So most of the time what you end up doing is you don't bring it home. You create your little crew and you deal with it right then and there. You know, if there was like confrontation, maybe I stole the guy's bike. You know what I mean? There's always ways to get even, you know, or his girlfriend. You know, there's always ways to get even. And, you know, so it's like...
Those things happen?
Sure. I mean, yeah. Of course. Every day is a celebration and a learning lesson in everything. Even today, like meeting you today, it's not like every day is a day of an opportunity to learn and move forward in this conversation of race, which is not something that happened in the past and today we're all clear away from it. You know, because it's, look at it on the highest level, whatever it is, whether it's owning a basketball team, it comes up, right? What does it come down to? It comes down to race. Or you have people watching soccer in Spain, they throw bananas at some of the top soccer players in the world, right? Or you look at politics or ownership of companies or something like that. So it's not like, oh, one side has it and the other side is completely home free. Not at all. We all 7.5 billion of us in the evolution of race and indifferences in spiritualities and sexualities for acceptance. Look at the young girls in Nigeria, what they have to suffer through. So it's a different type, right? But it's tough.
Do you know who the Swedish rap artist Timbuktu is?
Yeah, of course. I know Jason very, very well. I grew up with him.
Ah, you did?
Sure. I know Jason is one of my dearest friends.
Okay, cool. I interviewed him like a few months ago, and he talked about the Black Spring in the 90s. He was born in a fairly small town called Lund in Sweden, and he's sort of short as well. And he was, up until he was like 15 or something, he felt that racism was all over. But somewhere in the 90s, maybe with MTV or something, actually rap music, when it hit Sweden in the early 90s, he calls it the Black Spring, I think. When, like, suddenly he was, like, and his friends were, like, the coolest kids in Lund. Can you relate to that?
Well, Jason been a cool cat from a long time because Jason comes from, he stands of the legacy of, his father is one of the coolest people you will ever meet. His father is from right here in Harlem, actually. So Jason has a very good base of coolness, you know, and I think that maybe in the 90s, other people got around to see his coolness, but he's always been a cool kid, Jason. And now the world, especially Scandinavia, sees it. But I mean, all of this is exposure, right? MTV was started in the early 80s, as you know, and the person that broke the color code is Michael Jackson. So Michael was the one that exposed in many different ways blackness, right? to the world. It wasn't that it didn't happen, it wasn't there before, but true exposure to people's living room, right? So with that, Michael brought a lot of things that we knew were in black neighborhoods, like Moonwalk, like the music and the dance. And that was the first exposure. And then Prince, and then eventually came hip-hop with Run-DMC. So, and eventually, you know, more and more and more. So it wasn't that that stuff wasn't around. I mean, way before that, you know, with Miles Davis and with all the jazz culture, it was just like that wasn't exposed to the majority of the world, which the TV really does, right? Radio and TV really has those things that you can be part of people's everyday in a way.
Yeah, Miles Davis might not have been like a major star among the 14 years old.
But, you know, I think its impact does not, for me, really count in terms of album soul. I think if I think about impact, I can't imagine impact in terms of coolness. I can't imagine a person that had more impact on pop culture and coolness than Miles Davis in many, many ways, and made her think in a different way what sound could be like. But I do think that every era has its own. So now today, maybe that MTV might be YouTube, right?
Yeah.
That has this incredible power of reaching. And black coolness has always been around. It was just underexposed in terms of exposure. It wasn't underexposed, undervalued in terms of talent, you know. Musicians always went known about it. I mean, you ask Paul McCartney from the Beatles, who did he go to see? Was his idol? Jimi Hendrix. So this has always been there, but it was very much inside baseball, inside of sort of these different walls. When what MTV and that era did was open it up. But of course, it was color-coded. So without Thriller and without Michael, that's why we have that today. So that paved the way for other things.
You got into cooking really early on.
Mm-hmm.
When did you know that you were gonna be a chef?
Well, I mean, chefing, first of all, being a chef as a profession, from the level of what I thought about it, travel throughout the world, wasn't really an option, you know. This was done by a gift that sort of my grandmother created in our home that I took and nurtured and worked on. And then it was very local goals. I wanted to be able to work in the best restaurant in Gothenburg at a very early age and knocked on every door to do that, and eventually I got to do that. That was my 6-month plan. But when you're around talented people, other things will happen, right? Once I got there, this guy told me, like, hey, you need to work abroad. I mean, what do you mean abroad? Like Norway? Or, and he's like, no, Europe, like Switzerland or France. So, you know, I can't say that that was my grand plan when I was 11. This is something that I got to love, but also then opportunities and positive things were put in front of me. And that's why.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
The relationship with mentor-mentee is so important, right? I got exposed at a very early age that this was attainable. You can live in Paris if you want to, but you got to work really hard. And, you know, for someone coming from G-Berg, coming from Gothenburg, to live in France, it was like, wow, that's really exciting. Like, what's France like? So that, you know, now I want to work in a 3-star Michelin restaurant. And this is before we had sort of, with the Euro and with the way before, where, you know, the countries in Europe was pretty locked up in terms of working permits and so on. So it was a lot of different hoops that I had to jump through to get it. And then on top of that, it was the color barrier, right? But none of that sort of, it was a lot of no's and a lot of a rejection. And I remember one time even I had the job because, you know, they gave me the job and I was very excited in France, to go to France. And then when they saw me, you know, how can this kid be called Marcus Samuelson and be a black kid from Africa? And then they didn't give me the job. And that was probably one of the toughest times to go back, you know, sit on that train, the 35-hour train ride and ride back home again. But none of that, it just made me clearer that clearly that was not my path meant to be. And it's not like I was 21 years old and was calmly about it. It was extremely painful, but it was not in the cards. But eventually I got to France and eventually I got to the 3-star Michelin restaurant. And my father always said, why would you want to work in 3-star? You don't even speak good French. Just work in a 1-star Michelin. But it was the one few times where I actually stuck to my guns and really, I didn't want to trade down in that sense.
You seem so focused.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you think that comes from?
Well, I think focus is come from a lot of different things. You know, first of all, I'm an immigrant to America. And America's been very positive and open to me. But I'm very grateful. But also the fact of you have to focus when you... I didn't come with a lot of money. I came with $300 to this country and a vision. So I understand that through work, I can move forward. I also am very clear on that as a person of color, as a black man, opportunities are not given the same way as it is to other. So if you have or given an opportunity or work towards an opportunity, you better take care of it because I'm special. I'm not that special. That card can be gone at any given time. So I'm very aware of that. I'm very clear. It doesn't make me angry or bitter. It's just like I understand. I've been in enough rooms to understand rules and regulations, and that creates focus.
Did you have any other dreams when you grew up that you would be like a professional soccer player?
Sure. I mean, I always thought I would. Up until 16, I always thought I would be a soccer player. I was actually very extremely surprised and shocked that I didn't become a professional soccer player. And that was heartbreaking in itself. But for a lot of different reasons, I wasn't good enough or strong enough or system of coaching, whatever. It's no one to blame. Like, end of the day, I took everything that soccer taught me, teamwork, hard work. Most of the time in soccer, people are very skilled, but not the most skilled is probably the one that makes the professionals, you know. Someone that has the total package of discipline, hard work, and finding, understanding positioning, because soccer is all about positioning, and being able to taking criticism and taking that and learning from that and doing something with that. You see it times and times again, you know. I think there's a lot of where there's a superstar kid in the youth that guy very, very rarely makes it to the professional. Then there's a guy or girl that might not be that skilled or talented, but actually figures out their way, and that's the one that goes to the pros. Very much like life. It's a combo. It's not talent could get you in the conversation, but hard work and humility sometimes, and sometimes mixed with luck and hard work. And it's a combo. It's like a recipe. We'll get you out of there, you know, whatever that out is, whatever you want.
You were schooled in Switzerland.
Mm-hmm. I did a lot of my training in Switzerland and in Interlaken, yeah.
What was that like?
It was great. I mean, we were about 60 kids from all over the world. So I worked at this incredible hotel called Victoria Jungfrau. They're still there today. I mean, it's an iconic, gorgeous hotel. And we were trained very, very hard to work extremely in an extremely rough and tough environment, but for extremely high clientele. And there were rules and regulations, and you were drilled to do this. And if you didn't, you were sent home. And I thought it was a very fair trade. People spoke French or German, or sometimes very rarely English or Italian. And so it was constantly different languages. But drive and work ethic was, you know, I didn't, my first language is obviously not German, but I taught myself German and somewhat French. And I was by myself for the first time, and it was hard, but I enjoyed it. I mean, I also created so many friends with my, you know, we had obviously bosses that were like 5-6 years older than us, and then they had bosses that were 5-6 years older than them. But it was this, you're in camp and you drive towards excellence every day.
But you're still scarred from that.
Well, I think scarred in a good way, that sense of that I understand drive and work ethic and work in a multicultural environment and high stakes. We cooked for everybody at that time in the 80s. It was like, whether it was Margaret Thatcher or Ronald Reagan, whatever was, you know, the big corporate company, you know. But we learned a lot. Like, we had Japanese clients, so we learned about Asian food, for example, and Japanese food. We were always in environments where we were always pushed. You know, I started to work in a garden before I started in the kitchen. That was a very humbling experience, and totally on the outside. I had to deal with, you know, at the time, it was a very confusing time because people spoke in so many different languages. So I developed sort of this, like, I don't want to say it was bulimia, but it was like more like, you know, I got so nervous every day, so I threw up. I threw up every day, you know, I threw up every day, once a day, and then I was fine. But, you know, it was clearly a very high stress, high level environment of energy and stress and stakes. But I remember the first day when I didn't throw up. That's when I'm like, wow, you know. So, this body is so strong, especially when you're that age. And it maybe took a year, but it's like, wow, I've sort of become, I understand this now. I know how to deal with this. And you're going to get screamed at and yelled at, and it's going to happen once a day, and regardless of the scenario. And as long as you just get through that 5 minutes, whatever that beatdown might be, you'll be fine.
Maybe times have changed, but I would assume that it was like you would be abused in different ways. Mm-hmm. Does the restaurant world, does it still look like that?
No, I mean, this is 20 years ago, so I'm extremely happy that we've evolved as manager and management from that time. The two things you never saw in the kitchen were women or black people, right? When you go into a kitchen today, you see much more of that. We're not where we need to be. The other thing is that management style of only fear-based management, it wouldn't work today. You know, I'm born in the 70s. If you would try that method with somebody born in the 80s, it would still function to some point. But if we take that management style to someone born in the 90s, it wouldn't work. It wouldn't work. They wouldn't bite. I mean, I'm lucky enough to work with people from millennials, but also people from different, you know, all different times of eras. And that's the one thing I know, that we have to manage and operate different. And that's a good thing. We're more, again, goes back to diversity. Because people are also exposed because of the internet, right? You can, you know, I remember in France, I had to walk behind my pastry chef. He would never give me the recipe, yet I could never make a mistake. But he would never give me the recipe. So how do you then learn in an environment where you're not allowed to make steak, but you can't have a recipe? So I have to walk around him and look, how many cups of flour did he take out? And then sort of estimate in my own mind, what does that scoop look like? Today, you can go on YouTube in a second, or you can Google that recipe, and you can have it. Now, I'm not saying one is better than the other, because you also learn enormous amounts of skill by doing that many, many times. But clearly, access of information is key. But then you also have to sift through all the noise and do, right? So I became a master of task and doing things and failing, but doing it and knowing. But if you only see something on YouTube and maybe you so only do it once, who is the one that's learned the most? You know, I think there's something on both sides. I'm not saying that I want to go back to this sort of late 80s abusive kitchen, not at all. But by repetition and doing something, it was very, very, it taught me a lot. And being challenged taught me a lot.
When was the last time that you, like, skällde ut någon? What's that in English?
Last time I screamed at somebody?
Yeah.
I mean, I challenge people every day, but I don't think my tone of voice, I mean, I explain, I set clear path and goals for my individuals that I work with. I'm not sure if I raise my voice is the way to do that, but I'm clear on this is not happening. You are right now not delivering in the way that we agreed on, that we're committed to each other. That happens every day. Every day. This is what we agreed on. This is not happening. We can't have very little acceptance for that. But that doesn't mean that you have to, because you scream, doesn't mean you're more passionate or more in control of the situation, probably less control of the situation. So I don't think the level of tone of voice, for me, is whether you're going to get, it's all about inspiring people to get the most out of people to enjoy the ride and to have them be partners and enjoy their task. I don't know any other business than the restaurant industry that is so much a people business, from the back of the house to management to customers to constant. So you're going to, dealing with people, you're constantly going to be, it's very, very rewarding because you're going to see people exceed your expectation and their own expectation. And it's also very, very disappointing because you're going to see the opposite. So it's very much about getting people to perform at a higher level that they thought that it would be capable of. And that's hard on every day. It's hard. It's very difficult. But it's also, that's the challenge. There lies the challenge. Because it's not so much, people don't come to Rooster, Red Rooster, to eat. People come to create memories, part of something. They're hungry. There's so many places they can go to. It's not a hunger-based decision. It's, I'm here. I want to see Harlem. I want to celebrate. It's an occasion that I want to remember. It's, I'm part of something. It's in my neighborhood. I've come far. I come from Japan. I come from Stockholm. I come from New Jersey. That's not a hunger decision.
You actually like built this place from scratch?
Yeah.
Or, yeah. So everything in here, like you've chosen it or?
Yeah, I mean, it's handmade based. And I thought the whole idea was that let's create something that is inspired from the past when Harlem had Supper Club. This is where they came from. So this was an important part. Just in the beginning, we couldn't afford it. We were lucky enough to have the President of the United States eat here when we didn't even have colors on our walls, you know what I mean? So this is, when I come into this place every day, I also see the evolution that we had a disco ball here. That was the only thing we had. And couldn't even afford to have, really even paint the walls because we ran out of money. But so I still thought that people will see our intention and our ambition and our try and the sense of dignity that we try to provide. So upstairs, we put everything we had into the upstairs part of the restaurant. And then I said, give me a year or a year and a half, and we will build it downstairs. And that's what happened. But it's all handmade. This is not shipped to us. This is carved out.
Oh, cool.
Everything is based out of a radio from the 40s. If you see the backdrop in there, it's actually a radio. And then the seats are out of old American iconic cars, you know. So the car seats and then all the art essentially from Harlem residents. So there's always a dialogue about art, musicians, storytellers, authors. So that's why we have our salons down here. So this is map and compass. All of this was in Harlem at some point and now we're bringing it back. And
someone told me that you felt that you had to live here to understand it before you started.
I mean, I needed the passport. I felt needed. I knew that if I'm going to do this restaurant and I'm going to do a big drum roll on it and create a lot of energy that would have a local recognition in New York and then a nationwide and then a global recognition, then I needed to know the neighborhood that I operated in fully. So I moved here, and for the first 5 years, I felt I didn't know enough about the neighborhood, so I didn't open a restaurant. I learned. Try to understand why wasn't enough farmers market here, why wasn't there enough fresh foods and all of these different things. Like, but there were also some jewels, some things that were really, really good. And it really was, again, I said, it had really good bones and those bones were done way before me. But I started to know my neighborhood and go to block parties and understand the beat. And 5 years into it, I felt like, okay, we've done the study. It takes like, 5 years to get a PhD? And I felt like I need to have a PhD in Harlem in order to project Harlem out to the world.
Did you still work in Aquavit at that time? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I worked, I definitely worked at Aquavit. And Aquavit is and always been a very important part of my becoming a chef. You know, it was part of my aspirations as a young cook that this was this place in New York that if you work really hard as a Swedish kid, you can work there. Like Swedish food, and is there Swedish food outside Sweden? You know, just asking that question was very strange for me. And Aquavit set that aspirations that, hey, of course. And it was my entry point to New York City, and then it became the place where I became closely identified with. And I was 23 years old when I had a chance to become a chef and there, and it was very early. And so today I'm in my 40s, and so it's been a 15 years journey that I knew at some point that I have to get off this train. I had to.
As I've understood it, you were the youngest cook to get a 3-star review in New York Times. What does that mean for a career?
I mean, New York Times is the leading paper in the world, so, or one of the leading papers in the world, if not the leading paper in the world. So obviously it sends, first of all, it sends a message. But like anything, it starts locally. And before it starts locally, you gotta have to do the legwork. And we did the legwork. We were working very, very hard on changing the food. And they came in many times and I didn't know it. So they ate the food. And they also, I think, they believed in the ambition and the project. And they were kind enough to support the vision. And it went from being busy sometimes to all the time. But like anything, like I don't look at the world, my work, as a backward machinery. You know, my feet are looking forward. And that gave me a welcoming passport to New York City. But then, like, it's really, what do you do with that? What do you do with that? And at 23, 24, it could be too young really to understand it. So I just focused on the things that I knew, food, and just try to evolve and be better and better and evolve the restaurant product. And for a very, very long time, we looked in. We had different tasting menus every day. We had vegetarian tasting menus, asking questions about environment and Swedish food and how far could we push it. And because food travels only in a couple of different ways, right? It travels through massive population, like China and India, or massive tourism, like France and Italy. And Sweden has neither. So how do you then project Swedish food to a lot of people that most of them actually never been to Sweden? So it was important to find common ground, but also then stay true to what I felt was not necessarily only Swedish ingredients, but Swedish way of cooking. And I sort of started to develop that, thinking about it from a seafood point of view, game cooking, like venison and elk, but also pickling, preserving techniques. But then I started to think about also, what does that look like? Well, aesthetic is very important in Sweden, Scandinavia. Minimalistic design. What does that smell like, sound like? What does nature fit in? So asking myself larger questions, and within that, creating a framework of what I felt my Swedish food was about, beyond meatballs.
Yeah. It seems like your cooking is so, it really comes from your heart in a way.
Mm-hmm. You need a basement, and that basement for me was French cooking. But after that, you still need some other things, and that was my love for my family. So I look inwards, and that family, from a child to a teenager to an adult, changes. But it just grows, right? So Sweden will always be part of that. So will my experience of traveling all over the world for food, and so will where we are right now. So I look inwards and outwards as inspiration. So that's why meatballs make sense in a place like Harlem, but so does berbere, the spice blend from Ethiopia, because I now feel like I know enough about that side. But so does still these French techniques, because that's where I trained. But so does also maybe the cured salmon does not have to be the same way cured as our grandparents did, because they did it out of necessity. We do it based out of flavor enhancers. So why don't we cure it so it has more sashimi taste the way it'd be done in Japan? So the techniques and the framework is there, but the textures and the tones are a little bit different. So I compare it to jazz, you know, where you have a bass, but then it's also like, just like jazz, it's based on a lot of improv.
But you don't get to improv on every dish, sort of.
No, but I mean, that's also where we have, I mean, all the cooks that works with us, whether it's in Sweden, in Stockholm, or in Gothenburg, or here, we share a common language, which is modern cooking. So the basement work is there, And then the vision, again, if you look at it from a jazz, it allows the cooks to improv, the chef to do some improv, because you got to be locally relevant. So it's the passion of food has to be there. The cooking basic skills have to be there. And what conversation do you want to have with an audience? This is an American brasserie that is a neighborhood restaurant for a big part of this community, which is a destination restaurant for another community, visitors, right? So I want to see this restaurant through American brasserie, and we're celebrating every day through fun dining, right? Down here is more of a supper club. So the right service, the right food, is based on what conversation do you want to have. If you go to a concert and you're going to listen to, let's just say, Timbuktu, well, that's the conversation that you're in the mood for. But let's say you go to the opera house, equally high level, but that's the conversation. Maybe you dress a little bit different, and maybe you even go and have champagne afterwards. Do you know what I mean? Like, it just sets the tone for how you, as a guest, set up your night. And neither one is not better than the other. They're both needed in a celebration of your everyday.
I was so impressed with your thoughts behind the President Obama first state dinner, mm-hmm. with the bread breaking and so on. Could you tell us a little bit about that? I'm not sure that our Swedish listeners are fully up to speed.
Well, I mean, being asked to do a state dinner is obviously something that I was very, very highly appreciative of, and I thought would be an incredible challenge. But I needed to, I felt like needed also present it so it had added some value. And I felt like if you have a big occasion, I always try to make it smaller. You're cooking for people, regardless if they're in suits and tuxedos, it's people. People actually don't know each other. So what would be one of the best ways? What would you want a party to be like? Well, starting with breaking bread is kind of nice, because then you're like, oh, hi. If you take the titles away, ambassador, so-and-so, and so-and-so, it's still people. So creating a bread basket with Indian chapati and American cornbread set the tone for both an Indian and American dinner, which it was for Prime Minister Singh. And as I researched more about Prime Minister Singh, he was vegetarian. So I felt there was occasion to really focus on vegetarian food. Because if you have a guest of honor, you're not serving steak to the person that is vegetarian. So it was looking at how was the state dinner set up, but also was it something we could add? I felt, from going back to Jackie Kennedy's time, most state dinners were French food. And I'm like, well, even if there wasn't a French minister there, I felt like, well, this is an opportunity to serve American food and Indian food. And also the fact that Michelle Obama had started her initiative with the garden. So we took a lot of ingredients from the garden. So there was, again, it's like how you enter a space and how you enter a dialogue and what conversation do you want to come out of that. That I think about that in everything that I do. What conversation do you want to have before, during, and after that? So creating a menu that was mainly vegetarian-based with humble ingredients that winked and pointed at Indian food, but also American food, was very appropriate for the occasion. And I hope my ambition and goal was obviously to have them, that they enjoyed it, and they did, because, they said that to me several times.
So. Yeah, fantastic. Mm-hmm. Do you get to vote both in Sweden and here?
Yes, actually. In America, absolutely, and in Sweden as well. Sometimes I feel I don't know enough about Swedish politics. I mean, there are certain topics that I know more about and I engage more in, but I don't know enough about Swedish politics. I feel like the sort of the politics I can be part of is really about hiring people and engaging people through labor, through work. And that doesn't really necessarily have party behind it. You know, I just feel like engagement in cooking is on both sides of the continents are my engagement, my contribution, so to speak.
Speaking of which, I mean, you've been living here for like 15 years, but you still do stuff back in Sweden?
I feel like I've been blessed by having, I think it's an amazing, I've been blessed to be able to have a conversation and a dialogue in two parts of the world several parts of the world, but particularly Scandinavia and America, there are two places that I care about a lot, that I've been maybe 100 cooks that's come from Sweden to work here in the States, and they go back, and it's this dialogue of inspiring young hospitality students to say, hey, you can actually work in America, and for American kids to say, hey, you can actually be part of working in Sweden. That is a legacy that I'm extremely proud of, and I know also that's been very helpful for a lot of cooks and waiters and hospitality students, because when I go back to Sweden, and I know a lot of my friends and ex-students, they own their own places, or they are in managerial positions within the industry, and we were part of that, you know, and that's very rewarding.
We talked a little bit about the difference between managing in Sweden and here in the U.S., but is there a difference between your personality in the U.S. versus Sweden?
I mean, first of all, my language is food. My main conversation is food. So ingredients-wise, yes, because you work locally with the ingredients. So yeah, I'll probably say that in many ways, because you adapt based on what's your top ingredients. But maybe I wouldn't say as an approach, but as you know, for example, if you have cod and mackerel in front of you, that's what, so the outcome of what you will cook will be completely different than if you have yard bird and chicken, you know, and that sets the tempo also very often of, but I think the framework is different. I see dining through a celebration, and people work very hard today, so for people to get together, it's very hard. So they want to trash you. I want people to forget all about all of that stuff. When they enter our place, it's going to be, finally, yes, and here we go with conversation. So I don't know if that I change it. I just feel like it's a little bit ingredient-based for me, and food is my language.
In what ways would you say that you still are Swedish or Ethiopian or American?
Well, first of all, I think your DNA, we're so fortunate that you can carry an identity, and it doesn't mean the same. It just has a very personal meaning, right? I can tell you in my love for positive and negative space, minimalistic design, is not coming from the U.S. That clearly comes from where I was raised. My love for African beats, it's in my blood, it's in my vein. When you see me crossing the street, you're seeing an African man. So it's very clear of my identity. And when you see me walking in Harlem, you see a man walking in home, right, at ease. So I never really looked at from an outsider to say, oh, you're 10% this or 20% this. It's like I know clearly where I was born, I know where I was raised, and I know where I live.
But I'm thinking maybe, I don't know, maybe you have a Swedish way of like thinking about things that...
Sure, and that's what I said in terms of my love for positive and negative space and minimalistic designing. That's a Swedish way.
Yeah.
Because my love for nature, I need nature. I'm very, although I live in a very urban city, I need to run and be outdoor. So I think that's something that, just this love for nature is something that I was raised with, you know, and I think because of public land, almost all land, majority of the land in Sweden is public land, we're very fortunate to be able to go out to nature, and our relationship with nature is very unique. Maybe Swedes in Sweden don't think about it, but once you get out of Sweden, you start realizing and appreciating these things that Sweden actually has that are unique and incredible.
Where do you find nature to run in then?
I go, there's a park outside where I live, and there's Central Park, and then very often when I'm off, I try to leave the city sometimes and just go to other places where it's close to nature, whether it's the ocean or whether it's the woods, just because I need to think.
Would you like to recommend something?
In difficult times, just cook your way out of it. It's one of the most calming and best way of sharing an emotion. You can be angry and cook beautifully. You can be really happy and express that. It's one of the best ways of just even going to the market and just buying the ingredients, thinking about who you're going to cook for, what mood you're in. You can express yourself.
I saw a TV show about one of Sweden's top runners in marathons, and she said that she can never think about anything else but running while running. Are you the same way with cooking?
I actually think a lot about food when I'm running.
And you think about running when cooking?
No, but I think that running is what, I mean, she's a professional, which I'm not in terms of running. So it's one of these things where I start thinking about things, about textures and how and why. And I think about my day and the people that I'm going to, think about my family, thinks about, okay, did I do the right thing about this, or do I have to improve the hair? And you know, so I think it's one of the few times on the whole day that I'm by myself, so I value that time very much.
You have children, right?
Yeah, I have a daughter.
Does she speak Swedish?
No, she speaks a lot of language, but not Swedish.
Okay.
Yeah.
Would you like her to learn that at some time? Or?
Sure. I mean, what's most important is for her to be happy, and I think language is something that, you know, I never had an argument with somebody that I didn't understand the language with. The arguments are very often with people you speak the same language with. So something like language, there's so many different ways to, she's a great musician, she can cook, she can do a lot of things, so there's other ways for her to communicate, you know.
Maybe you should get to plug your book, by the way.
Yeah, the book is called We Chef, and yeah, we've been very fortunate with the book, you know, here in America. It was 8 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, and it's in 10, 15 countries and all over the world, so I'm very fortunate.
Who would you like me to interview here in Värvet, on Värvet International?
If you get Prince to talk, it would be pretty good.
Thank you so much for your time, Marcus.
Thank you very much.
Marcus Samuelsson, such a humble, nice, really down-to-earth guy. Salt of the earth, I would say. And he is on television here right now. It's a program called The Taste, and he is one of the judges together with Nigella Lawson and Anthony Bourdain, among another guy. And well, I really, really enjoyed meeting Marcus, and I look forward to reading his book. It's called Yes Chef here in the US, and it's called We Chef back home in Sweden. My producer.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
His name is Kristina Görling Birro, and my editor is Lovisa Olsson. Talk to you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye. Hej då.